Today's program is brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. Welcome to Pizza Talk, and I'm here with Sarah Minnick, who's coming to us from Portland, Oregon, from, really one of Portland's reigning pizza giants. In fact, I read an article recently that said, between you and a Pizza Shoals and Ken's, you have made Portland the pizza center of the United States. I don't know if that's, you know, if we want to talk about that, if you guys want to claim those bragging rights or not, but you're one of the reasons why. Sarah, your pizzeria is what, Lovely? Is it Lovely's 50-50 or Lovey's?
Yeah, Lovely's 50-50. Lovely's,
so kind of tell me what the name comes from. And then if you wouldn't mind, just kind of, for those who've never been there and don't know you, kind of tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, so let's see, Lovely's 50-50. The name comes from, the 50-50 is half ice cream, half pizza.
Oh.
But really, it's mostly pizza. But we do sell a good amount of ice cream.
I've heard that the ice cream is pretty amazing, so I see where the other food comes from.
I just ate some last night. I never really eat it, but my son was like, go get ice cream. So we went down there and picked up a couple pints and brought back. I was like, this is pretty good.
We're going to circle back to ice cream in a bit, because I was at the restaurant, I would be definitely scarfing it down. But I want to find out more about it. But yeah, let's hear more about how it all came to be. I know it's at least 10 years old now.
Yeah, it's 10 plus years old. The name is from, so let's see, my sister and I have owned a restaurant in Portland for over 15 years. And the first 5 years we had a restaurant that was just more of a typical model. It was, appetizers, entrees, desserts, sit down. It wasn't fancy, but it was maybe what people consider to be special occasion for like a birthday or something, or anniversary. I heard that a lot. People would say, this is our favorite restaurant. We come here once a year on our birthday. And I was just like, I think I want like better odds. You know, like,
right.
I like that. That's really nice. But especially around the year 2000, when we started to have the economic downturn, my sister and I were like, you know, and we started to have kids. We wanted a place that was a little more family friendly, a little more casual, something that people would go to every week. And so I actually was just, I had the chef that I was working with at the time at our old first restaurant, which was called Lovely Houlihan's, which is where the Lovelies comes from. He had worked at Chez Panisse for like 5 or 6 years. And so there were a lot of times we went down and did some sort of research trips, went to Chez Panisse, went to have ice cream and pizza at the different, you know, restaurants down there that basically like Chez Panisse alums had opened.
Right.
And I was really, really.
It's like the mother house of an entire like generation of restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah. It really was. I mean, like, I think all the restaurants that people had that opened down there were the really inspiring ones, like Camino. And the ice cream place was EC. I was really enamored with their ice cream, a lot of seasonal fruit ice creams. And she had been the pastry chef at Chez Panisse. And so I just decided, like, that combination of things and seeing it through the eyes of like a real seasonality, but very casual and accessible, was what inspired me to open Lovely's, basically, and just try to have a more free-flowing space with an open kitchen, lower price point. And somebody said when we first switched, I don't have a good feeling about this. And I was like, what? Pizza and ice cream? You don't have a good feeling about it? I was just like, that just sort of blew me away.
Right.
But that made me a little worried. I was like, wait, really? Because I'm thinking it's like the perfect combination and it's going to be, you know, a sort of like slam dunk for everybody. Like, good for me, good for you. Everyone's going to benefit from just the accessibility.
And I would think about that, that time people would have said pizza and gelato. Instead of
right,
pizza,
yeah,
right, and maybe if you had said gelato, they would have said, "Oh, I feel a lot better about it."
Yeah, I guess so. Put the fancy spin on it. Yeah, I've been pretty like solid in maintaining that. You know, I think a lot of times people do associate pizza and ice cream with Italy, and at that point, I hadn't been to Italy, and I was like, "This is an American place. It's American pizza, American ice cream."
Yeah.
you know, I wasn't even really sure like what gelato, what the differences were, but I was like, I know for sure I'm not Italian. And so I'm not going to be trying to make
play that game.
Right. I know. I was like, I know about ice cream, but that's about it. So, so yeah, that's really the basis of it. And, you know, at our first restaurant, working with Troy McLarty, who was the chef there, I really got a pretty good dose of like meeting local farmers. I was very inspired working with them. And it was great to just like know the people who are growing your food. And I was just really looking for that way to infuse that into something a little simpler that I could do. Because he moved on to other things. And I just saw myself in this endless cycle of hiring chefs, and I realized it wasn't sustainable to keep doing that. I just didn't want to be like working with chefs who weren't owners. My sister and I wanted to maintain ownership. And so I just kind of threw myself into the pizza world and the ice cream world by, I made ice cream at home, in like, you know, the big thing with the ice and the rock salt, you know, and I would like give it away. I just make like gallons of it. I did that one summer.
But Sarah, you weren't really initially weren't trained on the culinary side. Weren't you more an art student at one time? I mean, how did you go from art to food?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had always worked in restaurants at a very young age. I got a job that was just my first jobs. And I ran like the student run cafe and the kitchen side of it, where I went to school in Rhode Island at Rhode Island School of Design. I actually have a degree in painting from there. That was my first degree. And so,
RISD. So yeah, there's an awful lot of chefs that came out of RISD from the arts.
I know it's true. I think it does go hand in hand with just like, you know, you learn a way of thinking that's just, that this creative way of thinking for me, I always like to do new things and those are the exciting things, or just kind of participate in the cycle of things like seasons and so I think that's actually what's really gleaned from going to art school is just that thought process of sort of challenging yourself, thinking critically about things like that. And that's what really helped me. And that's why I think a lot of chefs come out of art schools.
When you were in Providence at RISD, did you know the Joanne and George from Al Forno? Or did you ever eat it at their restaurant?
You know what? I didn't. I heard about it. I don't know what was going on. I think just being kind of a student was not, you know, in Providence, I did do some exploring, but really I remember, I don't even know where it was. I remember hearing about it and being like, I think it's too far away from my apartment. Can't go.
Student, you can't really afford to eat at Al Forno, but I mean, they sort of changed the world with their grilled pizzas.
And I know, course, big mistake not going.
And they're both RISD folks, you know, themselves. And
yeah,
and, Joanne really made her mark on the pastry side. As well as, you know, on the culinary side. So it seems like there's an awful lot of interesting, I don't know, even though it's indirect, some inspiration that seems to come out of merging the artistic side with the culinary side.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was a little terrified of learning pizza because just the few times I tried to make bread or pizza, I was like, this is hard. It takes a long time. But once I sort of calmed down and just really decided to learn it, it took a while, but it came a little naturally. Not to say that I don't just learn all the time still, and I just constantly learning more. And I'm not afraid to change things when I learn something. I mean, you know, not to say that I'm experimenting constantly on people, but definitely I'll just change all the dough for one day and be like, I don't know, I just added more whole wheat. I just wanted to see, you know, how it works.
Right.
And I'll be like, nah, it wasn't my favorite. And everyone got pizza with that dough tonight. You know, and overall, probably I'm the only person who could see the difference. But I think that experimenting is also what keeps it new for me and interesting. Using flour more like a raw ingredient, like a vegetable or something, and just really not being afraid to change it and be a little braver with it, I guess.
We've talked with a lot of sort of new generation pizza makers who also did not grow up in the quote pizza business or the milieu and didn't feel or weren't beholden to the Italian Neapolitan tradition. And so they didn't feel that they had to follow any rules. In order to, you know, they were free to kind of find their own way within the pizza world, which sounds like this happened with you. I understand, you know, you use a lot of whole grain. In addition to the toppings, which are, it sounds like farm to table driven, but your dough is also pretty high in whole grain influence too, right?
Yeah, it's at 40%. It has been for a couple of years.
That's a pretty significant amount, really.
It's pretty big. I keep thinking like, I don't know why we don't have 50%, because that would make sense, 50-50, or why we're not 100%, you know, and so I'll experiment, and then I'll be like, there's a reason we're at 40%. It's perfect. Like, I'm like, don't ever think it.
Called the Lovely's 40-60.
Right. Yeah, good idea. New idea for a restaurant name.
And the pizzas are cooked in a wood-fired oven, right? They're kind of,
you know, we had a wood fired oven for the first 10 years, and I just changed to a Pizza Master.
Really? See, everyone's jumping on that Pizza Master bandwagon. You really?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to say that we had a wood oven for that long, and it was really challenging and interesting to learn how to cook with it. And so when the pandemic hit, we were sort of faced with, we've just been doing to-go pizzas now, and the volume has really skyrocketed. We were doing about 140 pizzas in about 3.5 hours, which for me is a lot. And we used to do maybe 100, 120 in 5 hours.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot more deck recoup time and just time to keep the fire, you know, to manage the fire, which took a lot of time. But once, and I have wanted to switch for years now, just because I wanted a more consistent bake. I didn't want to sit there and have my little wood, my big wood, my thing. And I was like, the oak, the alder. It's like, I kind of just drove myself insane with that. And I mean, because you have to, in order to get kind of more of a bread baker's approach to pizza, to get the temperatures you need, and you're sitting there with a gun, and you're just, it caused me so much anxiety. It was like, all I did was think about it, you know? And so I wanted to switch. I was scared to switch too, just because I think there's a lot of romance around wood. It is a beautiful way to cook. It looks beautiful in the restaurant. It's very cozy and warm to go into a restaurant and light a big fire and roast all your vegetables. I mean, I loved it in that way, but, switching to the Pizza Master has been a 100% game changer, and it has helped me get over the trauma of trying to maintain deck heat, you know, and especially when we were switched to the high volume for the last 4 months. For the first 2 months, we did it with the wood oven. I mean, it was painful.
Did you have to make any changes either in the formula or the baking times using the, is it gas or electric driven?
It's electric. Yeah, it's electric. I was ready to, because I've used the Breville, and I've used Pizza Master at Pizza Expo and different places like that. And I thought maybe I would need to maybe add some malted flour, some malt, just to kind of help with the browning, or, you know, I wasn't exactly sure, but no, I didn't have to make a single change. They definitely cook longer, but that's what I've always wanted them to do. I've always been like, so now I have three decks. We can fire 9 pizzas at a time. And they take about 8 to 10 minutes. And I think in the wood oven, we never could let them be in there that long, because live fire, you know,
burn them. Yeah.
Small, you know.
So what are you baking at, about 600, 550?
Yeah, 590.
590.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it is.
And pretty great.
Well, you know, Brian Spangler, who you know from a piece of Shoals, who's a big fan of Lovely's. I mean, he's the one who said, you've got to get Sarah on the show. He's one of my favorite quotes from Brian is when people used to ask him way back in the beginning when he was not using wood fire and everybody else was doing wood, and they said, why aren't you doing wood fire? And he says, I believe it's the quality of the heat, not the source of the heat. It's the quality of the BTUs, he said, that makes the difference. And so he just decided not to go that way. And while I think you're right, there's a huge, you know, reason to stay with wood and do wood, especially, you know, at this time when wood fire is so hot and there's romance and everything else. From a functional standpoint, you need a deck that can put out a lot of pizzas, and you need to be able to maintain, you know, temperature and everything else. It seems like there's a move back towards deck ovens. And
yeah, I mean, people have a real romance around the fire stuff. I don't.
You've chopped enough wood to have paid your dues on the wood chopping.
Definitely not. And I have a little back oven, you know, backyard wood oven, just one of those little Stadler made ovens. And I'm almost over the trauma to be able to use that again.
Like, I still have my little Primavera, Forno Bravo single pizza oven. I can do one pizza at a time in it, and I fire
Sounds
it up
good.
Times during the summer. And I love cooking other things in it besides pizza.
Oh, me too. But yeah.
So it is fun, and when you have people over, you love to fire up the wood. But if I had to do that and crank out 100 pizzas a night or 200 pizzas a night, I think you sort of at some point, hit the wall. On the other hand, I'm sure it's great training, for young folks coming up to learn how to master the WFO ovens, and be able to, learn how to cook.
I'm sorry, I think you cut out a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is the Zoom world that we live in. We get
yeah.
so we just plow through it. But anyway, do that in your own curve, so to speak. You've gone through the wood fire thing and now have an oven that you love and is giving you volume and consistency without any trade-off in quality.
Yeah, I don't have to think about that part of it as much. And I definitely do. We tinker with the temperatures all night just because I think that's one thing you really learn from cooking in the wood is it's like you have to tinker. When I was first working with Breville, they were like, you don't have to turn the pizza, just leave it in there. It has all this stuff to like cook. And I was like, no pizza maker is not going to turn the pizza. I was just like, it's just, we have to, it's going to happen. You could say that, but like, I'm unfortunately not going to be able to do that.
I have to turn it anyway, because it's too dark in the back, if I don't turn
it. Their big thing is it's supposed to be so magic, it's supposed to work in this magical way that you think, and it might, but I'll probably never know because I won't leave one in there without turning it.
I'm not going to risk that one. I'm not going to sacrifice.
I can't. It's just.
Well, before we run out of time on this segment, and I know you're going to do a little show and tell in our next segment, but I did want to ask you if you could talk a little bit about sort of your philosophy of ingredients, having kind of been influenced by the Chez Panisse, vision, which really was the start of the farm to table movement in America. It sounds like you do a lot of work with local growers, farmers, and then you're constantly changing up your pizzas too.
Yeah. I think that once I figured out the real connection of knowing farmers and grain growers, farmers, it was really something I couldn't do without. And just the excitement of printing a menu every day and having farmers bring you stuff that you might not even know is coming and just working with it. At first, I think people think it's a little challenging, especially if you hire people who work in other kitchens that have more consistency and stuff like that. But for me, it just came, it automatically made sense. And I find that to be the really fun and fulfilling part of it. Also just the quality of ingredients is so much better. I think at Lovely's we've used straight farm produce all year round. We live in a temperate climate in Oregon, but for 8 years, and so I haven't seen pretty much any old produce coming from California or Mexico or it's coming. And because in the first years when we had to sort of supplement in the winter, that stuff would show up and I'd be like, what is this? I'd be like, this stuff looks terrible. And I remember someone looking at me and be like, oh, you are so spoiled. Yeah, I guess. But like, I just noticed the difference is so big that it's just not something I can like compromise on anymore and just haven't had to, which has been really nice. I mean, with the pandemic, we have had to do, the volume is a little different. And so, it's been not as creative because we have to be, we have to use kale the whole week. We have to use, so it's not as fun. We can't have special pizzas on one day usually, but it's still there. And I know hopefully in the future we'll come back. So,
yeah.
But, yeah.
So on a typical night, I don't know if it's changed during this sort of curbside period that we're in now, but how many pizzas are on the menu? How many different choices do you offer?
Right now it's like 5, and usually it would be 7 or 8, and we'd have a bunch of appetizers. Back when we had the wood, there were a lot of wood-fired vegetables and salads. We kind of had to let go of the appetizers because right now it's just actually me and my sister running it. just because it's not safe to have a bunch of employees back yet. And we're just trying to keep it, so you know, distanced.
And yourself.
Huh? Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the creativity is, and every time I do try to be a little creative, I'll add something and I'll just kill myself and I'll be like, okay, well, you know, we can't.
So for right now, you're not shuffling up the menus every day or every week based on.
No, we're just open 3 days a week right now. And we sell about 140 pizzas each of those days. And I have to set them for the 3 days because people are ordering via text and I just want to keep the consistency there. So it's not as fun, but nothing is as fun right now. So that's just the bottom line.
The pizza community has made an amazing pivot, I think, during this period. And so many places have survived where other styles of restaurants haven't been able to because of this. Number one, finding sort of the groove. Everybody wants pizza. They're willing to come in a tight little window and pick it up. And and you don't have to necessarily focus as much on the creative side as much as getting people the pizza that they need, you know, and that they're this almost
right.
Like a logical need as much as a culinary need for good pizza right now.
Yeah, it's true.
Are you doing ice cream right now as well?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think we're selling about 150, 200 pints a week. We're just selling pints.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll come back on part two. Let's talk more about ice cream, and what do you guys think you're going to show us? Show and tell for us in part two. What were you going to do?
Yeah, I'm going to make you guys a little pizza. I actually went out last night and we have a pretty big garden at home here. And so I snipped off a bunch of stuff. I'm just going to make a little summer pizza demo.
You're going to do it in your little Breville oven, right?
My little pizza YOLO. Right. Yep.
We'll be right back with more Pizza Quest right after this break.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth has made specialty cheese in the rolling hills of Wisconsin for more than 30 years. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style Grand Cru cheeses. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome back to Pizza Talk. I'm with Sarah Minnick, and she's coming to us from Portland, Oregon, one of my favorite cities in the country, and definitely, I would have to say, the most interesting food city in the United States. So many great ideas. It's an incubator for great ideas. And Lovely's 50-50 is certainly one of them. So Sarah, thanks for being with us. And I know you're going to make something for us right now, aren't you?
Oh yeah.
We've been talking about
catch it. Breville, I was doing that
little
now.
Breville oven.
Okay. And, bear with me. I'm moving over.
And as we get going, you'll be able, for those who don't already know about the Breville Pizzaiolo oven, you'll put it in action. About a year ago, and they sold out immediately. So now I think people have to wait till the end of the year before they can order them again. But
is that true? I better quit telling people to get one.
Well, that's what I heard.
I better wait. Good to know.
Originated in Australia, it's a single pizza, a little electric oven designed to replicate a wood-fired oven. Interesting angle.
Yeah, it has actually like six settings. So it has frozen, pan, New York, thin and crispy, wood-fired, and then you can go up to like 900 degrees, and it has like a hacker mode where you can change the different temperatures around.
because everybody likes to hack their oven. They don't want to follow the settings. They want to do it their own way.
I know. They totally thought, they're like, you're going to want to hack it. I was like, no, I'm just going to use the thin and crispy setting. Like, that's totally, right. I'm like, I don't need to tinker.
I use it for my deep pan pizzas. I do like a Detroit style, but it's a round pan. It came with it and it makes a perfect, I set it at, I think it has a setting and it's somewhere around 475 to 500 degrees. And in about 16 minutes, it bakes a perfect deep pan pizza.
Yeah, you know, this thing is really great. I work for Breville sometimes, but like beyond that, this thing is amazing. It heats up in about 15 minutes. The first time I worked on it and used it, I had it at work and I just like took a pizza. I was working and I plugged it in the back and I just like took a pizza and put it in there. And I was like, just expecting, I don't know, I've used a few different little ovens and just expecting like, yeah, I'm sure I'll be fine. But it actually just looked exactly like the ones we were doing in the wood-fired oven. And I was just like, wow, okay, I get it now. Right. It's like, that's it's impressive. Actually going to work.
Yeah. That moment they had you in the palm of the
hand. Oh yeah, I was pretty happy about it. I was like, okay, good. I can really, really work with this. Okay, so, hold on 1 second.
So you're going to make a pizza using your dough. Is this the same dough you use in Lovely's?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So I'm going to make now. So I just went, like I said, last night and got some little cherry tomatoes. One of our popular pizzas at Lovely's, we put flowers on the top. So I picked out some flowers. And usually I'll just kind of trim them up so they're not too obtrusive. You're not eating like a whole flower or something like that. You'll just get it for aesthetic purposes mostly. And just because it's pretty fun to, I'll show you at the end, to get that put down in front of you or in this case, order it to go. So I'm also like a pretty big fan of shaving ingredients and getting them very thin and use at Lovely's a lot of raw ingredients on pizza and not a lot of pre-cooking of things. But this is the way that I get them to cook nicely. So usually I'll take, I got some summer squash, I shaved it and put it in here. I got these little confit tomatoes. Usually I confit them just to get the liquid out. And so they're not too liquidy when they go on the pizza and they don't create like a big, you know, watery mess.
Yeah.
And then I have basil here. So this is a pizza we have right now. And we have this every summer for a pretty long run, usually a few months or as long as these things are in season. So basically I tossed in here, it's summer squash, cherry tomatoes, basil. I tossed salt and olive oil. I seasoned everything. And then I always put a little parm in there too. And it kind of coats all the veggies. And then when it's in the oven, the parm is melting and helping the veggies cook.
Nice.
So I had that. So basically every pizza has that method. And I just have these, let's see, little doughs here. These are my little guys. These are the 40% whole grain ones. And this is, I gotta say, this is like pretty awesome way to proof things. You can mix your dough in like a Cambro 12 quart. And then you can kind of clean it out. And then I use it as a proofer.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
That way you're not having a bunch of separate equipment for things. And I love these containers anyway. I have them all over the house with like rice, flour, whatever else you got in there. And I can usually proof. These are 250 gram dough balls. Lovely's, we use 400. So these are a little smaller. I make them a little smaller for the Breville just because the deck is a little bit smaller.
More typical to a Naples style weight.
Right. Usually this is the size we use for kids at Lovely's. I like a lot of crust and not too thin usually. So and then I use a mix of semolina and whole grain flour as my bench flour.
And you mentioned that your dough has 40% whole grain in it. Is it whole wheat or is it some other
grain? Yeah, it's whole wheat. It's a mix. It's so I have 60% central milling flour in here. Uh-huh. I use a little bit of High Mountain High Gluten and the rest is Artisan Baker's Craft.
Uh-huh.
And then I the other 40% is from Camas Country Mill, which is a farm and miller Southern Oregon.
Yeah, very
and
well.
So it's a mixture of spelt, hard red spring wheat and Edison flour. And so it's a combination of those three whole grains. And it's kind of, I keep messing with it and changing it around, or I'll use Durum or something different in there. And I just keep coming back to this mix. It's pretty good. I like all three of them for different reasons.
Yeah.
The highest percentage is Edison flour, which is a white wheat that was actually developed here. I think it was maybe in Washington. And I think the story is that it was made and it really has some of the characteristics, just at least visually, of white flour. And so kids like it if they're kind of thinking like, I don't like whole wheat or brown bread. I want to get this white wheat, this Edison bread, Edison flour. And so they were using it like schools.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of, for bread.
You talk about a hack. You can
hack, I know.
Hack your flour by giving a white wheat instead of a red wheat, and they think they're eating white flour.
Yeah, exactly. So, so this is my little method. I got my dough. I stretched it out. I don't do the smashing thing. I like there to be some gentle bubbles and things like that.
Stretched out. And I usually that dough is very extensible. It seemed like it just spread.
Oh yeah. Quickly. Yep. Yeah, this is a pretty high hydration right now. I'm working with it's about 74%.
So yeah.
And so I always lay down a layer of aged mozz. This is grande aged mozz. Every pizza gets that as a base, American style. And then I usually just do like a single layer of toppings. So this one, I'll show you. And then I have on each pizza going usually about maybe like 3 or 4 cheeses, sometimes more. So this one has the grande. And then I'm just using a little bit of this. It's a local cheese from Washington. It's organic. It's called Sleeping Beauty. And it operates a little bit like Fontina. It's not quite that strong of flavor, but it melts beautifully like that. And then this is another Washington cheese that's a sheep's cheese, fresh sheep's cheese. And I just kind of dot this on the top. So
is it a soft cheese or is it a...
Yeah, it's kind of like Chèvre or Fromage Blanc. So can you see those sort of layers? Yeah. And so... Sure. Everything's layered on here. It's going to cook nicely. The top is protected with a couple layers of cheese. And then this one always comes with a little drizzle of this stuff. I don't know if you use this stuff, but it's olive oil pressed with oranges and they have a few different flavors. This is the orange one. I do lemon. It's an Italian ingredient. And it's really good. It's pretty strong. I just put a little bit on top, but it's nice with the cherries and the cherry tomatoes.
Come through the flavor.
Yeah, big time. It really does. Yeah, I have a couple of people ask for this pizza without it. And I'm always like, what? Yeah. Okay, fine.
You got to have it. You got to have this. All right. So now that you...
Okay, so I loaded that. It's on thin and crispy. It probably will take about 8 minutes.
As you opened the door, the stone came out to meet you.
Yeah, that's why this thing is great for... That's why this is great for home. It takes out some of the more frustrating things that you can imagine people go through at home when they're making pizza. I think people's biggest anxiety is getting off the peel.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, you can't use too much bench flour. I actually think like somebody started a fire, maybe using too much bench flour. I don't want to say it was Scott Wiener. Maybe it was Scott Wiener. Anyway, he... We're on the Breville because he put too much bench flour in here.
We're gonna have to ask him about that one.
Ask him the story. Oprah might have been there. I don't remember. Anyway, ask him. I don't know. Anyway, somewhere in New York. Anyway, so
in his little Breville oven, he set it on fire.
I think so, or at least set off the fire.
Oh yeah.
Alarm. In a big building in New York, and Breville got in trouble or something. I don't know.
Find out from Scott what happened. We'll let you all know.
Yeah. Ask him. That's the great thing about the oven. The deck comes down, it lowers down, and then when you put it back up, it rises back up so it can get the elements on the top to be cooking the top of the pizza.
It's a really nicely designed, you know, a piece of equipment.
It's awesome. I mean, you can touch it.
Giving them a lot of shout out. They're not one of our sponsors or anything, but they have been. It was kind of a breakthrough tool, and I don't think anyone has copied them yet, or you know, done anything quite the same as what they've got there.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's worth, like, people ask me all the time because they want to make pizza at home or backyard or whatever, and it's just when you find something that works, you have to make sure people know about it. It's like, okay, because I mean, inside, you know, at home, you kind of have your choices are pizza stone, pizza steel, and just working with your home oven, and a lot of times, you know, it's really hard to get the same results as you would professionally in a professional oven. And
I gotta ask you something. See steam, or is that steam or smoke coming out?
Yeah, it's just steam. Yeah, steam.
So we're not in the
Scott It's just because of the tomatoes. No. I'm not doing a Scott Wiener fire in here.
That's normal for that to be venting a little bit of steam or smoke. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's fine.
And what do you have it set for? What, for a Neapolitan style pizza? How long?
This is thin and crispy. I'm using thin and crispy.
So what's it, about a 3 to 4 minute bake?
No, I'm going to be longer. It probably will run maybe 8 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Well, here, let me get my, let me turn this thing.
That's good. While it's baking, we can talk a little bit about ice cream.
Okay, yeah. Here, see, you can see, like, it's still got a ways to go in here. But it's okay. Getting some of the bottom getting cooked.
Some color, yeah.
And this also has, like, a dial that you can do the top lighter or darker. But you can really get this too hot. I've fired this thing up, and it's been, like, you know, it's way too hot.
I know. I saw some of their early demo tapes, you know, the videos that they made, and they had various famous pizza makers doing them. And and one of them came out, and half the pizza was, like, charred, you know, beyond where they really wanted it. So, of course, the camera zoomed in on the other half that wasn't dark, you know. But that's just all about the cameras. I think it's not fair when somebody goes and does a demo for them and they haven't had a chance to practice on it, you know. They're,
yeah.
It's kind of all or nothing.
Yeah. It took me a while, too, of doing a few different events with this. They're great for teaching and stuff because they're very portable.
Well, I'm going
to get it right. I kept trying to use the wood-fired up setting because I was like, yeah, that wood-fired setting, that's what I would use. And then it's too hot, actually.
In September, I'm going to do a video for Breville with Scott, but I'm going to do the pan pizza in there because that's been my sort of focus lately. And I love that round pan that it came with. So,
yeah.
We're gonna film it on a Friday, I think. I don't know if it goes out live or if it goes out tape, but sometime in September we're gonna do something in that oven. But I know the 50-50 was about pizza and ice cream. So can you tell us a little bit about your ice cream philosophy? Because ice cream, like pizza, there's so many different ways you can approach it.
I approach it really similarly. We did used to make cones and sell lots and tons of cones of ice cream, and now we're just doing the pints. But so it's a little bit bigger batches, and kind of the same thing that's happened with the pizza. We've had to streamline it a little bit and just have, I think we have about 5 flavors right now, and a couple of like just basic classic ones that we have, and some seasonal ones using raspberries and stuff like that from a few of our favorite farms. And but same thing. I mean, it's just nice to work with some ingredients. I steep a lot of like herbs and different things that grow just in Oregon and even just from my yard. And it's nice to just work that way seasonally with the same products. And we use dairy from Strauss Dairy in Northern California. So we have organic ice cream.
So you bring it all from California. That I know Strauss is very beloved in the San Francisco area. That's a long way for it to travel to get to you, though.
We order it by the 2,000 pound pallet.
Is there something about that particular milk and the dairies that they're getting their milk from that differs from, say, something you could get in Oregon?
I mean, there's not that much to get in Oregon, strangely. I think that because what most ice cream places are making ice cream in volume, these dairies go through and they make sort of a basic custard base. It's kind of a blank base that's already made that has the eggs already in it. Uh-huh. And so once you reach, like in our peak, we make 40 to 50 gallons a week. And it's been many times that we've run out of the base and had to make it from scratch and separate all the eggs and do all that. But that's really not very sustainable if you want to make that much ice cream.
Unless
that's all you're doing and you have like a very diehard philosophy of really wanting to include that step in your process. But so in Oregon, I don't think that there's a couple of dairies that do it in Southern Oregon and they're not organic. And there's usually like corn syrup or additives and stuff like that. But Strauss makes one that, Byright uses and different places in California uses. I think we're the only people in Oregon using that here.
Well, we did an episode of Pizza Quest when we were out on the road filming, and we went to Byright Creamery in San Francisco in the Mission District, and they just started giving me like spoons to taste all the different flavors, and it was, I couldn't stop. You know, it was like, they kept saying, "You want another one?" I said, "Of course, I want another one." The flavors were unique and original.
Right. Yeah. So basically Strauss supplies you with an organic base that we cook almost every single flavor, usually steep herbs or, you know, we have a lot of melted chocolate and stuff like that you add. And so that's sort of the process that we go through. We definitely have to do a lot of work to get to the finished product.
You must have a big ice cream maker though, to be able to process that much ice cream.
No, I don't. I should have one. It only can do 1 gallon at a time.
So, wow. So you're just continually making ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of going on in the background while everything else is happening. Yeah. You know, it's okay. I thought about getting a bigger one, maybe some point.
But that's part of I think why people love these 50-50 is that it's still very artisan. It's like you're working, you know, you're working in larger volumes, but you're still doing everything very artisan style, you know, small batches and the personal touch, that the fact that you're personally involved in every step of the way is probably, and your sister.
Yeah, I've always really liked that part. I mean, I've never wanted to, I've always felt uncomfortable kind of leaving it. Even if I'm just gone for out of town for a little while, I'm always just kind of like, or have a night off. It's been kind of fun to just be in complete control of it now. And I've actually learned, you know, a lot more about, because my process has changed a little bit, I've been hand mixing a big part of the dough, and it's been kind of fun, and I've gotten really, really more connected with hydration and fermentation, doing it that way. Even though I've been making dough for, you know, almost 10 years, that part of it has really, I've learned a lot in this past few months doing it that way. And just being, I think the connection of like making the dough and making all the pizzas, I'm just like, I'm very, very connected to what's going on with like environment and my starter. And I've really learned a lot, which has been the sort of flip side good stuff to operating in a pandemic, you know.
I think that there's something so grounding about working with dough and having your hands in the dough. It's one of my favorite parts of bread baking is just handling the dough. And it does connect you. Like you said, I think there's a theme that has emerged through these interviews is the sense of being connected to what you're doing. And being connected.
I agree.
It's you have a pizza that we're about to connect with here.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I'll just show you. This is a good shot of that. Can you see it?
Yeah, it's got a nice little char.
Because I can also let's give you a little view here this way, because this is looking, well, maybe the light's a little bit better. Oh, wait, this is Zoom.
There we go.
Okay, Zoom. Right. Okay, there you go. So there it is. And then
the aerial view.
You got to get the flowers on there.
And so the flowers are big. I know flowers are kind of almost a signature item, aren't they?
Just on this pizza usually, but yeah. So, okay. So I'll try to, sorry, I wasn't quite on that display. There we go. So yeah, got the flowers on there. Yeah.
But look how the flowers really kind of make it pop.
Perfect. I don't know. Check this out. Breville. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Really nice. All right. So you guys at Breville, you're getting a free shout out here. Thank you.
Anytime.
For making this happen. So that would be kind of a small version of an actual pizza that you serve it.
Yeah. This is one we've been selling about, I don't know, 100 of these a week right now, just being open the 3 days. But yeah, so it's a lot of flowers. We go through maybe like 6 of these containers. So you go out, I have my little snipper scissors to cut them all down. But that's the fun part. And we still get to have this pizza, which is great.
What kind of flowers are they? Are they nasturtiums?
These are, they're nasturtiums. I've got some dahlias in there.
Dahlias are edible, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You can eat the bulbs too. They're kind of like potatoes. You can like shave them. I mean, they're not, the potatoes are better than dahlia bulbs, but only had dahlia bulbs or something, you could eat those.
Survive.
And calendula, just whatever's out there. Delphinium, is that what that is? Yeah. So usually we plant a lot of flowers out here just so we have extra. And I get flowers from farmers too, because I don't have that many flowers. But
I love how they make the visual aspect of the pizza pop and provide contrast. And it just adds another dimension.
Yeah, I think some people are like, oh, it's a crutch. You know, I hear people like complaining about flowers and cooking, but to me, I'm just like, it's just so fun and beautiful. I think it's a big part to eat, to have food be beautiful too. I don't, you know, I think I've heard people argue that it doesn't have to be. And I think that like deliciousness and beauty go together. So I'm kind of like, well, I guess, but I think people get a lot of joy out of like, even just having a pizza with flowers, like land on their table at the restaurant, or in this case, open up a box, box and get one.
When you were in art school, did you have a particular area of focus of an aspect of art that you were focused in?
Yeah, I have a degree in painting, fine arts.
So, and the reason I'm asking is because obviously composition is such a big part of the fine arts and visual arts. Do you find that you draw upon that sort of foundation in composing some of your pieces?
Yeah, big time. I think it does help too with, I mean, it's funny when you think of a pizza and you're, when you're building it, you're making it, you know, for each piece to sort of hold its own because you're going to cut it in pieces. And so you have to make sure each piece has a little of the toppings on it, especially when you're working with things that aren't just like cheese and pepperoni or, yeah. You know, and I want to make sure like every slice is going to have a tomato, every slice is going to have this, you know? And so I think it's helpful to have that sort of balance when you're building pizzas too. And they are super visual. It's like every single one, you're looking at it that way. And, you know, making sure that, yes, it's beautiful, but also it makes sense from an eating perspective.
Well, I know that it's early where you are, but it's lunchtime here where I am. Would you mind vicariously sharing a slice of that pizza with us?
Yeah. Let me see. Let me get my, let me find my pizza slice. I can't find my little slicer, but I'll use the scissors.
Okay.
Yeah.
As we say, enough talk, time for the eating.
This is such a cute little pizza. It's just a little, just a little baby pizza. I have to say the proof was a little bit short just because I balled it up, you know, so yeah. Didn't get quite the spring, but, you know, you can see, yeah, it's a little light on spring, but oh well, still going to be great.
And now how old are your kids?
I have a 15-year-old daughter and my son is 9. So there's a little slice for you.
Oh, there you go. That's beautiful. Yeah. You did get a little nice puff in the.
Usually I go bigger for the puff, but.
Yeah, but still.
Can't be picky at, you know, 9:30 in the morning. Exactly. I don't get up that early. But yeah. Mm.
But the kids must never get tired of having pizza.
No, they don't. I don't think any of us do. We're just like, I mean, that's what this is great for too is, usually I'll bring home dough on Sunday if I had some extra from Saturday at work, and they're all getting pretty good at stretching out their pizzas. So I have 2 nephews who are 9 and 10, yeah. And my son's 9, and they're like pretty into it and like getting pretty good at it. Cause you know, it's hard. It's tricky. It's intimidating. And especially if you try it once and something gets stuck on the peel, you're kind of just like, and disaster happens and you just don't really want to do it again.
You're traumatized.
But, yeah. Totally traumatizing. I know. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for not only sharing your story, but your pizza with us today. Would you mind just another little tilt of that pizza so we can see the top and how beautiful it is? I'd love to leave.
There's a bite out, but yes.
I'd love to leave that art shot, so to speak.
There you go. Shot.
And who knows, maybe this could be one of the pizzas that we feature in our new book, in the pizza
question. Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, thank you so much, and congratulations on all your success. And,
thanks,
you know,
Peter.
And are pivoting so well, as I'm sure you, all of you in Portland, have some sort of a culinary community and communication with each other. And I know you're all pulling together to get through this. And, you know, thanks for being a big part of the Portland story, you know, as well as the pizza story. So,
yeah, thanks for having me.
So, and thank you all for joining us on Pizza Talk. We're with Sarah Minnick. Lovely's 50/50. When you're in Portland, you've got to go check it out. There's, you know, as we've been hearing, Portland is becoming, you know, really one of the pizza epicenters of not only this country, perhaps of the world, because there's so much, not only great pizza, but very creative work being done there. Again, thanks, Sarah. And we'll see you all
in the
episode of Pizza Talk. Thanks. Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.